All right.
So thank you, Boris, for that introduction. So I'm going to tell you about some work we've been doing at the interface of biology and physics. And as Boris said, I was a hardcore condensed matter theorist, 1D exactly solvable models, conformal field theory. And I took Boris and Anirban Sengupta came over when I was like in my third year of grad school. And I took these two courses with them, one with Boris and one with Anirban, and they really pretty much convinced me that if I was going to continue being a scientist, which I wasn't sure about in PhD, but I did, that I was going to switch fields and work on quantitative biology. And so here I am. And the reason was, of course, because quantitative biology is an exciting field. There's lots of interesting things happening. So by now it's cliché to talk about how much data there is, but there really is a lot of data. And this is because the cost of sequencing keeps dropping and dropping and dropping. So here's a little graphic. There's a million of these on the web, but here's one from the European Bioinformatics Institute. And you see this is in terabytes, and this is how much data they have stored. And starting in 2009, you see there's this explosion of data. And this is, you know, it's actually gotten steeper if you interpolate this. Come on, you have to appreciate data coming from where you're coming from. It's okay. My advisor was his student. So having said that, it's not just the quantity of data that's increasing. It's also the quality of data, right? So now we can imagine measuring at the single cell level multiple genes over space and time in a way that was unprecedented, that you couldn't think about, you know, 10, 15 years ago. You have to remember GFP only came of age in the late 90s, right? So we're still talking less than 20 years later. And every month, there's some new way of measuring something quantitatively in a biological system. So this is something that came out of David Weitz's lab. It's just a random thing I chose because I noticed it, where they basically can actually measure the forces in a cell colony by using like these kind of microfluidic gels. It actually looks like a very cool and interesting thing. This is not the kind of data I usually work with, but maybe Boris would be interested. It's pretty interesting, but the point is that there's always new techniques and new ways of quantifying that are popping up all the time. And so for the last.
The first author is a professor at UCSB on that paper.
Is he? Oh, well, that's good. That's a good
hire. I don't know if
you're
meeting with him, but he's here. Yeah. He's not in the room right now.
Well, you can tell him I plugged him. I hyped him up. Anyway, so the point is that we've been thinking about how to make sense of this data. And I would say what we've been really trying to do is some kind of phenomenology. So we've been inspired by basically condensed matter and high-energy experiment and the success of phenomenology to try to see, can we make phenomenological theories of biological systems? And we've been working on a bunch of stuff. So we've been spent a lot of time thinking about information processing and biological networks. We've been thinking more recently about theoretical ecology, a microbial community assembly. And the reason we've been thinking about this is that we've been actually revisiting all these classical papers in ecology by MacArthur, Wilson, Levins, but now we have data. We can measure the relative abundance of every species in a community, in a microbial community, something these guys could never imagine. And so we've been rethinking about these things and thinking about how you can use ideas from statistical mechanics to understand this, as well as machine learning. As Boris said, we've been thinking about collective behavior in cellular populations, and this is stuff done in close collaboration with a lot of experimentalists. And more recently, because of all this data, we've been thinking about stuff about machine learning, bioinformatics, and physics. And we got some hype for some of this stuff, which is okay, recently in Wired and in Quanta. So I'm not going to talk to you about any of that stuff. What I'm going to talk to you about is two other projects that I've been doing. And the first part is going to be basically trying to think about how we can use ideas from physics as a lens into the biology of cellular reprogramming, right? And this is basically something about how cell identity emerges and how we're using ideas from attractor neural networks and spin glasses to try to understand this. And then the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about how thinking about biology, I think, can tell us something fundamental about physics, and in particular, the physics of information. And this was largely inspired by hanging around a lot of synthetic biologists at BU. So let me start with the first part. So the basic, which is basically this idea of how we can use physics to try to understand cellular reprogramming and cell identity. And the basic problem that I'm interested in, and lots of people are interested in, but it's a fascinating problem, is that if you look in your body, there's lots and lots of cell types. There's neurons, there's blood cells, there's fibroblasts, there's stem cells. And they look morphogenically and genetically nothing alike. right? And yet, I mean, morphogenically and like phenotypically nothing alike, yet they're genetically identical. They all have the same DNA. And the question is, of course, how do you get such different cell types even though they have the same DNA and they're genetically identical? And the answer we know is that there's some complicated interactions between the genes that make up stuff, but we'd like to understand this better. Of course, I'm not the only person thinking about this. This is the whole field of developmental biology. And there's a lot we know, right? Over the last 60, 70 years, we've worked out a lot of the molecular biology. The scientific community has worked out a lot of the molecular biology of how this works, right? You start off with some pluripotent cells, and pluripotent cells are cells that can turn into any cell type. And you get differentiation to different germ layers, endoderm, mesoderm, ectoderm, and eventually you end up with these specialized cell types we know about. You know, heart cells, lung cells, you know, blood cells, neurons. And this process happens through an amazing kind of self-organization where you have complicated spatial-temporal profiling of different signals appearing at different places, at different times. And generically, the idea of development is that you start off with a pluripotent cell. This is a cell type that can give rise to many, many cell types. And you end up with these specialized cell types at the end. And the question is, how does this all happen, right? And this is basically developmental biology. Well, developmental biology in an organism is very hard. So we're going to play with what are toy models in this talk, which are basically these in vitro systems. And the reason we can do this is because of these incredible experiments that were done by Yamanaka and Takahashi in 2006, which are these cellular reprogramming experiments. And what Takahashi and Yamanaka did was that they could turn on the expression of just four genes, basically overexpress four transcription factors. And transcription factors are proteins that can turn on and off other genes. And by doing that, they could turn a fibroblast, which is basically a piece of a cell in a connective tissue, like cartilage, back into a stem cell-like state, which are called iPSs, or induced pluripotent stem cells. So as far as we can tell from all the bioinformatics that were done, they're basically the same thing. So you just by turning on four genes, you could turn a fibroblast back into a stem cell-like state, an iPS state. And this is really rather incredible, because you have to realize there's 20,000 genes. There's 1,600 transcription factors, and this kind of minimal perturbation, no one ever really imagined that you could be able to turn something back into a stem cell, and then take the stem cell that you get, this iPS, and redifferentiate it into the cell types you care about. And so this kind of overturned basically 60, 70, 80 years of dogma that you always went from pluripotent cells to differentiated cells. And instead, it made us think about what cell identity really means and how fluid is cell identity. And since this 2006 protocol, there's been about 7 or 8 protocols published of different veracities, different amounts, you can believe them, but there's been published protocols to turn fibroblasts into skin cells, fibroblasts into cardiomyocytes, fibroblasts into neurons, and neurons into stem cells. But it seems like if we just knew what transcription factors to overexpress and what medium to culture things in, we should be able to turn cells, one cell type into another cell type.
Just ask a question. Are you surprised that you could reprogram at all, or are you surprised that reprogramming is just with four genes? Is the number four surprising, or just the ability, period?
Well, we knew you could do it, ability, because you could take the whole nucleus, and you could reprogram that way. So those were 10 years earlier than that. Well, they're both kind of surprising, to be honest. They're both kind of surprising. And I mean, taking a nucleus of one cell and putting it in another cell is a very dramatic thing, right? It's very different from turning out four things in 20,000 or four in 1,600, which is probably a much fairer comparison, and being able to reprogram. And what's more surprising is that it doesn't seem to be something special about stem cells, which was initially thought. There's at least one other believable protocol, which is from fibroblasts to neurons, which is done by Marius Wernig up in Stanford. So, yeah, and ask me questions, please. I'm a physicist. I start getting nervous when people aren't asking me questions.
So when you stochastically induce, means you induce and some of them do and some of them don't.
Yes. So more about reprogramming. So how do these experiments work? Because in my opinion, they're the most exciting set of experiments I've seen in the last 15 years, more than the Higgs. Here's my other high energy. Much more than the Higgs. It's my other little high energy jive. So the idea is to turn on and off expressions of cell type specific genes and proteins. So if I want to go to a cell type, I turn on some specific transcription factors that are elevated in that cell type I want to go to. And directory programming is this stochastic. So it's extremely small. So the way it's usually done is you put up a bunch of cells, fibroblasts, in a 96-well plate or whatever plate, and you wait 3-4 weeks. And after some time, these numbers are more like 14 days now, but this was back in 2008, which seems like ancient ago then. And you basically, with some very small probability, 0.1%, 1%, get these iPS colonies forming. So these iPS, again, are these stem cell-like states. And this is basically some markers, and you can watch these things, and they kind of stochastically reprogram. What's even more interesting to me, so not to any other biologist I've ever talked to, is that sometimes, instead of getting the iPS cells you want, sometimes you end up with these partially reprogrammed cell types. And what these are cell lines that have stable gene expression, so you can passage them, and the gene expression doesn't change, but they don't correspond to anything you find in your body at all. So they don't correspond to anything. So they look like new artificial cell types that can exist in vitro that don't exist in vivo. And so the question we'd like to understand is, how can you get these partially reprogrammed cell types?
And they split and divide.
They split and divide, and you can passage them.
What does passage mean?
And you split them. So we also have some more data. So in the last 3 or 4 years, people have been trying to think about some dynamics. So you can basically show this beautiful paper by Hanna in 2009. You can basically show reprogramming is well fit by a Poisson process. So it looks like a single rare event. There's even more interesting papers, the same thing, the Hanna group, which is really, I think, the gold standard in this field. They knocked out one deacetylase. For those of you who know what that is, you know what it is. For those of you who don't know what it is, doesn't matter. The point is, they knocked out one protein. And instead of having stochastic things in a secondary system, and it doesn't matter. For the biologists who have some questions, you can ask me afterwards or now. You can basically deterministically switch all the cells after 4 days. So instead of taking 2 weeks to 3 weeks, you knock out one protein, you deterministically switch these cells. All right? It's a beautiful paper. And people have been trying to basically ask, how do you imagine this trajectory, right? You start off with a fibroblast, which is some gene expression in some high-dimensional space, and you ask, how do I end up all the way at a stem cell? And the idea is that you can try to visualize these, so people basically pull down cells along the trajectory with different markers, and you try to visualize how this path goes, and people usually try to visualize this through what's called PCA. It's a dimensional reduction techniques, and it kind of looks like this. So we'd like to basically make sense of this phenomenon, right? And biologists would like to make sense of this phenomenon too, and there's actually been a return to some analogies and metaphors that were very prominent back in the 30s. So Conrad Waddington was a famous developmental biologist in the 30s in Britain. And he was thinking about development, and he started writing down these kind of funny pictures here. So these are pictures from his original book. And his basic idea of development was that development should be thought of as some kind of ball rolling down a hill. And so the idea is that you had this developmental potential, you started off as a pluripotent cell of some kind, and as development proceeded, you went to the minima of these developmental potential. And so these minima here basically corresponded to differentiated stable cell types. And what's interesting is that this is the picture you usually see, but he actually had a second picture where he imagined this developmental potential coming out from the interaction of some kind of molecular unit. And so the idea was that this was some kind of emergent property of some interactions, which in our modern language we would say somehow this kind of developmental potential and this cell type evolved from some kind of complicated genetic biochemical network. And so this is what Waddington proposed. With cellular reprogramming, now that cell type doesn't seem to be as hierarchical, people have started revisiting this kind of idea, and they basically draw these pictures of rough, rugged landscapes where, again, cell type is basically visualized as minima in this potential, and stochasticity basically induces transitions between these kind of different things. And just to be clear, this is not physicists who are making these analogies. These are really biologists. So this is something from Nature Review Molecular Cell Biology. All right? So people are really trying to make sense of these experiments on some kind of holistic systems level way. How do we understand these? So I was at BU. I was sitting in Jim Collins' group meetings. I kept seeing these pictures. And if you're a physicist, and you stare at these pictures long enough, there's two questions you should always ask. The first question are, what are the axes, right? So I got taught two things by all the Russians, by Sasha Zamolodzikov at Rutgers. He told me, always ask me what the axis was, and when someone said big and small compared to what, right? So this is how you can tell I'm a physicist, because those are the two questions I always got taught to ask, and I haven't forgotten, right? So here's the question. We go back to these questions. Go back to this kind of thing, and the question is, what are the axes? And what the hell is this potential? What sets the height? What is a meaningful valley? What is a cell type? How robust is it, right? And so what I'm going to try to convince you is that by answering these questions carefully and trying to mathematize this metaphor, we can actually have a surprising amount of quantitative and predictive power. So and so let me start by basically trying to answer these questions, right? And what I'm going to be able to do by answering this question is turn this kind of picture metaphor into a mathematical metaphor. And then we'll see if the mathematical metaphor has any power. All right. So the question is, how do we construct such a landscape? And so the first thing we have to do is define a cell type. And so what we'd like to do is we'd like to define a cell type. And a cell type for us is going to be defined by its gene expression profile. So I have 20,000 genes. In particular, we're just going to focus on transcription factor genes, which are, again, proteins that turn on and off other genes. The construction doesn't really rely on this choice. It just makes it more tractable. And what we're going to do is now we're going to imagine there's 1,300 of these, and we can get data for about 63 cell types. And what we're going to imagine is that we're going to imagine a cell type is basically defined by a vector in this 1,300-dimensional space, where I basically imagine that I have different amounts of each of these proteins on and off. All right. We know that the biology is actually very complicated. There's histones. The data we would like is actually much more specific. We'd like things on different kind of histone marks. These are kind of marks that are known to be important in epigenetic regulation. We'd like, you know, quantitative things on protein levels. We don't have all that. What we really have, surprisingly, even after I talk about how much data we have, the only data that's really available to us are cell type specific microarrays. And these are AFI-430-STs for anyone, probably not in this audience, for anyone who cares. And we're working in mice, right? And so the basic idea is that we wanted to understand, really we were thinking about histone marks. And histone marks are basically, it turns out DNA is wrapped around these histone proteins. They have little charged tails. You can modify the charges. And depending on what marks they have, genes can be on and off. We didn't have that. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out how we could infer histone marks, K27s, for any developmental biologist in the room. I have lots of slides on this. Trying to figure out how we could go from microarrays to gene expression marks. We couldn't figure out how to do it. But eventually what we did was that these marks, you either have them or you don't have them. So the data, the natural state space is then binary. And so what we did in the end was try to turn this continuous transcription factor expression into a binary transcription factor expression. And this roughly, you can imagine, corresponds to whether you have a K27 repressing mark or you don't have a K27 repressing mark. It's not exactly right, but it roughly is a very good proxy for that. And so now my each cell type basically corresponds to a binary vector, plus or minus one for each of these 1,300 transcription factors. Right? So you give me a cell type, it has some gene expression profile. And so that basically defines my cell type, and this defines my space. So the important point about this space is it's extremely high dimensional. And remember that high dimensional spaces work nothing like low dimensional spaces. Right? And that's going to be important for anything that follows. So once we have the state space, we can ask, how do we construct this actual landscape? And remember, this is the basic phenomenology we're trying to capture. Again, I'm trying to do phenomenology here, which is that each cell type is a vector, which we get from our gene expression profile. Each cell type is a basin of attraction, right? So the whole idea of this landscape is that this cell type, there should be some energy function such that this cell type is the minimum of that energy function. In addition, these things, basically these basin emerge from basically some kind of effective interactions between these genes. And these could be effective, these are correlation-based, so we want to understand how we can construct interactions between these transcription factors such that the cell types are the minima. And furthermore, this landscape is probably rugged. right? That's the picture the biologists tell us, that there's other bases that don't correspond to the cell types I actually see, and these perhaps could correspond to these partially reprogrammed cell types. So there's lots of metastable states. So the game is, I give you a bunch of vectors, right, which correspond to my cell types, and I want to construct a potential landscape such that the minima course of this landscape are these, basically these vectors I give you. Well, it turns out this problem has already been solved in the greatest biophysics paper ever written, theory, biophysics paper written, in my opinion, which is this Hopfield network, right? And subsequently by lots of people's work by Daniel Amen and others. And there, he basically was thinking about how do you store memories in neurons? And the basic idea was, I gave you a particular memory, I had interactions between neurons, and I made a potential surface such that the minima of these memories were these things. It turns out the simple Hopfield network doesn't work because here you have lots of correlations, you can generalize it, you can do lots of stuff, you can do it, but the spirit is the same. It's basically the same thing. And so what you can do, since this problem has already been solved, is you can write down a Hamiltonian, right? Which, as I say, is basically an obtuse mathematical formulation. And the point is that I've taken this picture analogy and I can mathematize it, right? So far I haven't done nothing, right? So far I've just turned something more obtuse. But this math, just for the more quantitative mind, it could be understood very simply, which is my energy basically can be understood using this picture here, which is that it's basically linear algebra in disguise. And so the basic idea is that I take the plane spanned by all my existing cell types, and if I take an arbitrary gene expression profile, this S, which is some basic thing, the energy of that state is basically proportional to this distance to this plane squared. Right? So my thing came out and got stuck. Right? So the basic idea is the energy is somehow basically proportional to the distance to the plane spanned by the cell types that exist in vivo. And that's basically this term here. And then the point is we're doing phenomenology, so we can add terms that basically, in some culture, you can imagine some cell types are more stable or less stable than other cell types, so we can add some terms that do that. We can also add terms that, in response to some signal, switch you from one basin to another basin. All right? These terms aren't going to play any role in what we do because we have no data on that. I'm just being honest and just saying that the model allows for these kind of terms, which we don't have. So the basic idea is that we can write this model, and so far I've done nothing, right? I've taken a picture and turned it into a mathematical picture. Now the question is, do I get anything for it? Yes,
Omar. This might be a dumb question, but what plane do you choose?
I choose the plane. It actually, because of high dimensions, it turns out it's not that important. You take the plane spanned by all the cell types we have in our database, but you could take half of them. It doesn't matter. You can take a third of them. The basic phenomenology doesn't change. It's basically all the cell types that I think exist in vivo.
Okay.
It's a construction that ensures that, this is a construction. In this construction, all cell types have equal energy. The predictions of this, I'll tell you, and then the idea is that if I put it in a certain culture, I can lower and raise these things. The culture is actually the magical dark horse in all these reprogramming experiments. That's where all the magic happens. That's where all the alchemy happens, actually, it turns out. It's pretty interesting.
So how about the dimension of the space? So if you take half of the transcription factor, so how far down can you push it?
We're nowhere near the loading dimension. The loading dimension in these construction goes like linearly with n. And even in the Hopfield thing, it goes like 0.13n. And so 1,300 transcription factors at most, you have 80 cell types. We're nowhere near loading.
So you can basically push it down to...
You can push it down to anything reasonable. It won't make a difference. So let's come back to the data. So we're doing phenomenology, right? And the test of a phenomenological theory is, can it explain some data? Right? So let's look at the data. So remember the data, the dynamics data I want to explain. One, reprogramming looks Poisson, right? Second, you know, that you have these kind of, you want to understand how whole genome expression profiles basically change over time. And thirdly, you know, we want to know, does it make a difference that in this dynamics, I can deterministically switch after one day, everyone switches, or I take 3 weeks to switch these things? So the first thing is, unsurprisingly, you can run some simulations and you get Poisson, you can reproduce this kind of Poisson statistics, but that's kind of just saying that I have a barrier crossing. No big deal. The second thing that's interesting, and this is just replotting data. I just want to point out, this first next few slides, I'm just going to replot data, where I'm going to replot data in a very particular way. So the second thing that's going on is, can we make sense of how the dynamics of this gene expression change over time? And the basic idea is that I have some thing at day zero, I end up at stem cells, and now instead of living in this PCA state where the PCA vectors are very uninterpretable, I'm actually going to use the fact that I'm basically doing linear algebra in non-orthogonal coordinates to basically now replot this in this plane where one axis is the projection onto the fibroblast, the other axis is the projection on the embryonic stem cell, and this third axis is this energy per transcription factor. And what you see is that these blue are reprogramming trajectories that successfully reprogram, and red aren't. And this is data from four labs with three different methods, something like that, right? Of reprogramming. And what you see is they all seem to lie in this simple one-dimensional line. Furthermore, you see that the energy of the not reprogramming ones are higher than the ones of the lower ones. And so this seems to suggest that this is a good way of plotting data. So plotting data is pretty much what, to me, that's like a sign of a good theory. If you can plot data better, that's already like 80% of the way. Yeah, go ahead.
Could you comment more on the parentheses at the bottom, why it doesn't matter?
So this is done. So this part is just, again, like I said, plotting data, right? And so the idea is that these plots are probably continuous data. So the idea is that once you realize that really underlying this whole construction is this kind of linear algebra kind of approach,
yeah. But
then you just do linear algebra. So there's only one part. I'll show you there's only one set of results that actually depend on constructing the landscape, which is this idea of what partially reprogrammed cell types are. The rest of it is mostly going to be learning how to plot the data better. So we just have a way of, if there's certain directions you care about in a high dimensional space, you should use those as your basis vectors. We stumbled on this in a very backward-ass way, but that's essentially what we got. The energy thing can also be viewed, right? The energy, again, because I told you, the energy can also be viewed entirely in terms of linear algebra because it's basically a distance from a plane. So this is really linear algebra in some sense.
Sort of remind me what the axes are.
this is the projection on the fibroblast vector.
What you have on the two ends.
Yeah.
Yeah, the two cells, I see that.
Yeah, so the fibroblast corresponds to some vector. Yeah. The embryonic stem cell corresponds to another vector, and I just project on that. Right? And the energy is the orthogonal distance to the plane. And this energy changes a little bit depending on what cell types you include, but not much.
And these trajectories are experimental.
They're experimental. And I'll show you more. It gets more interesting. So we can reproduce this basic idea with our simulations. What's interesting is you can actually take, so these are three different experiments. This is the longest time course we have, 2010. This is the deterministic one that I showed you. This is POLO. This is the 2012. This was the first comprehensive study. And you can plot these things, and again, they lie on this simple one-dimensional plane. And what's interesting is that it doesn't matter that if it takes 8 days or if it takes 30 days, they all seem to lie on this simple kind of reaction coordinate for reprogramming.
So what's surprising is this is narrow rather than...
Yeah, yes, right? Exactly. It's surprising. Well, you could argue that maybe if I pin the two ends, this is the only way it can be.
It could be for wide.
Yeah, we haven't. Look, I yeah.
There are other directions.
Yeah, there are. There's a huge number of directions. But again, you're pinning the two ends. There's a bias in how the experiments select for markers. You know, we're really surprised it works. But there's many reasons you can imagine that the experimental design is the reason it's looking like this.
And we're projecting onto this plane, and so. The points have to fall somewhere on this plane.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, when you change something a little way, the projections are going to just change a little bit.
Yeah.
So it could be one experiment does this, another one does that.
It could.
But it's not. I mean, they could.
Yeah, okay. I wish I was as confident that there was something more as you are. I agree. I mean, what's more interesting?
What are we taking from that?
I think what you're supposed to take is this a good way to plot data? There's a simple reaction coordinate.
That presumes that there's something we're learning from it. And what we're learning is that this isn't just all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's what you're supposed to take away. That there's a linear progression, it seems, in this thing. And I'll show you a trajectory where there isn't a linear progression, which is kind of interesting.
If you're looking at the fibroblast to neurons, for example, on this plot, what does it look like?
Oh, the neuron, the fibroblast, there's no one that's done whole genome expression profile for that. Marius hasn't done it yet. So Marius is going to send us the data when he does it.
Okay.
So the problem is you don't get very many neurons in those things. The yield is really low.
Is it surprising that the failed, I mean, whatever, I think the red lines from the previous one also go along the 1D, that somehow the gene expression profile for the failed trajectories starts the same way as the correct ones and doesn't go in a different part of the plane? Is that, or am I thinking about it wrong again?
Well, you're doing the same thing on all of them, right? It's not that the protocol is changing. It's the same protocol.
Yeah,
some wells reprogram, others don't, right? I don't know. I don't know. The more interesting thing is they have higher energy. Does that mean anything? I don't know. These are all interesting questions. To me, this is like why there's some interesting things to think about.
They stop the red ones because you don't make it.
Yeah, you don't make it. They just get stuck. So let me show you another version.
Your energy scale is arbitrary.
Yeah. My energy scale is arbitrary at the moment.
The function of that, what you define
as
energy.
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely. We're the early days. We're trying to figure out what's going on. Yeah.
But presumably the reason they have different energy is while having the same projection on your two directions, they've gone in
arbitrary dimension in the other two dimensions. Exactly. So they've projected off. But in those two dimensions, they're in the same place, right? You're progressing. You can imagine even that two things, you basically take the diagonal line between embryonic ESC and whatever, and fibroblast. So this is the same thing with just on the one-dimensional plot with times. And you see what's interesting is that some trajectories get stuck here. This thing gets stuck for a week here. This thing gets stuck for 2 weeks here. This is the deterministic one. And you can see again, it's at least a really nice reaction coordinate. And so this suggests some kind of, like, you know, in protein folding, people like to think about funnels. So this is something I stole from Peter Vohl in this thing. And I just flipped it upside down. And so you can imagine what you really have is some kind of rugged barrier crossing. Right? So it's like an inverted funnel picture. What's interesting is that you can keep on plotting data. And so here's a different experiment. This is a reprogramming experiment from B cells, the embryonic stem cells. And here you see that it does something a little bit different. So this, again, a projection on B cells. Here's a projection on embryonic stem cells. And basically, you start here. This is, you know, basically, this is the culture. Brings you here. And then you get stuck in this kind of thing here. So this is what it is versus energy. And what they then do is they pulse this CEBP alpha, which is basically some global B cell transcription factor that opens up chromatin. And so what you can imagine that's like doing is that's like introducing noise. And so they pulse this thing, and you see you make reprogramming much more efficient, and you can program much faster. And the question is, are they doing something like simulated annealing? Are you getting out of the barriers because you're pulsing these things? I don't know. The data would suggest it's not. It's not. It might be true. So I would argue that at least it's a good way to plot all this gene expression profile data. There seems to be a simple reaction coordinate that tells you about how cellular reprogramming works. It's surprising that that you can take the 1600 dimensional space and visualize everything in terms of an energy or some orthogonal projection on everything else and a 1D coordinate. We're really happy with this stuff.
Can you explore other directions as well?
You can. You can. And one of the things that do that, we would argue, are these partially reprogrammed cell types. So here, let's think about how would we really test this landscape Hopfield-like models. What's the real qualitative prediction that you make? And the qualitative prediction of these kind of landscape construction we use is that in addition to the minima you put in, you should have other metastable minima. And those metastable minima have a very particular form. They have the form of a mixture of existing cell types. And so there were 6 partially reprogrammed cell types that have been whole genome profile. So this is the stem cell field. This was really hot in 2009, and then everyone abandoned it without coming to any resolution because it's, you know, it's stem cells. And so you can go back, and indeed, what it looks like is that you have random projections on existing cell types on all 6 of these things. And they're not the ones you start with or the ones you end up with. And so we would say this is really consistent with this idea that these partially reprogrammed cell types are spurious attractors. And to me, this is the best test of the landscape model, even though no one cares. Yes.
You're selecting trajectories which make it there, where it's going to go from A to B. So that's what fraction of the total trajectories make it?
Oh, very small.
So tiny. So in a way, it's not so surprising. I mean, I'm not surprised.
You're not surprised that way.
But how do you select the red ones then? They didn't make it.
Well, they just waited. So you.
Well, I can tell you the experiment. Do the red ones eventually make it or not?
Well, I mean, they don't make it on. I would say they don't make it because they have a high projection.
No, but there's a lot of other ones that don't make it. So why don't you plot that? Why these red ones?
Because they made it some other way. So you have markers, and you select on some markers on the progression coordinate, and they sit there for a long period of time.
Okay.
I think it's a perfectly reasonable. It's a perfectly reasonable experimental setup, right? You do go through wells and. I can draw you the diagram. It's going to take me a long time, but essentially the idea is you go some way, you select on things that have the marker, then you wait, and then you select. I'll show you the experimental. It's easiest done in a figure, which I don't have.
But what if you take trajectories that? I mean, there must be some trajectories, which are then projected onto this plane. They move around a bit.
But you're imagining you know where a cell type is ahead of time, right? You need markers, right? You can't access these things, right? I mean, first of all, they're on the colony level. And second of all, you can't do single cell. I'm just imagining what experimental setup you're imagining.
Well, how many markers do you have?
We have about 6. That's what everyone uses.
Okay, well,
well, you can oscillate between. It means nothing and it means a lot. But I would say it's at least a good way of plotting data. I mean, the more interesting thing to me is these partially reprogrammed cell types looking like mixtures, which no biologist cares about at all. At all. What they want instead, you have a question, Boris?
Well, maybe finish the sentence.
I was going to transition. What they want is lists of transcription factors, right? And so the idea is, so now you can ask me the questions because it's going to be moving on.
But so the number of spurious cells in Hopfield model depends on how much you are trying to pack into a space of a given dimension.
Yes.
Right? So.
But not in these.
So
not
the
not
fact
in,
that you're
No. But the energy of the spurious attractors depends on that, right? And when you say number, you mean really the how much the how many are accessible?
Yes. So I guess.
But in this projection method, right? And remember, Hopfield models very much relies on the fact memories are uncorrelated. Otherwise, the whole construction breaks down. So it doesn't work at all. And so the whole thing is, so what you do in this method is you basically put an inverse of a correlation matrix. And then what happens is every cell type that lies in that plane of existing cell types has zero energy. So there's no lack of things that have zero energy. You just don't see them very often because they're high dimensional. And you live in a high dimensional space. And in fact, I would argue that there's some kind of inverse, in these interactions, there is an inverse correlation matrix being thrown in.
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking is I wonder whether you can learn something about, the number of relevant dimensions from the fact that, in 25 experiments, you detect 5 or something.
Yeah, you can, because it depends very much on how you go off-road, in some sense. It really depends on, do I have good viruses? Do I have bad viruses? Do I have good docs construction? Do I have bad docs construction? If you're dominated by the setup of the experimental variability. And we've been trying to get vials of these partially reprogrammed cell types for 3 years from Catherine Plath. When I see her in UCLA next month, I'm going to go bug her. And we can't get them. Everyone has disappeared them. This is stem cells, man. But in principle, yes, but it's technical variability is what's killing you. So you can't. It's an interesting thought. We thought about it, but we can't even get our hands on these. So the next thing biologists always want is lists of genes. And so what you can do is you can make plots like this. So the idea is can we predict what transcription factors you should overexpress if you want to go to a given cell type? And so the idea is that we can make plots like this, which is that you give me a cell type, so say embryonic stem cells, and here I plot the transcription factor expression level. I did it as z-score. It's not really relevant. It just makes the data squish. And then here you predict what is basically the predictivity of a transcription factor for a given cell type, which you can imagine in two ways. It's the how much that contributes to the projection onto that cell type, or how much the energy of the landscape changes when I flip that transcription factor to on and off. And this gray stuff is stuff that's sensitive to binarization, so we I'm just plotting it out. This is stuff that if we binarize slightly differently, you would end up with different things. And these things here are overexpression candidates. These things here are knockdown candidates for practical reasons. No one likes knockdown candidates because it's hard to knock down stuff cleanly. And so this is for embryonic stem cells. You can make these plot. These are these Yamanaka 4 I told you about. And this is a zoom in on that thing. And these are all transcription factors that have been implicated to either speed up reprogramming or slow down reprogramming. So you see, we do pretty good. Most of this stuff is very sensible. We can make this plot for every reprogramming protocol. Many of these plots were made before these reprogramming protocols were published. This is to cardiomyocytes. We don't believe this protocol, but we do pretty good. This is to liver. We definitely don't believe this protocol because we've been trying to reproduce it for 4 years and no one can do it. We can't do it. We can't get protocols from the people who published it. But we do, in principle, do good. This neuron protocol from Marius Wernig, we actually believe, but we don't have a good collaborator to work with neurons, and we do pretty good. And this thyroid one came out afterwards, and you see we do pretty good. So we were pretty good at. So the idea is that using these kind of plots, which are basically linear algebra again, so nothing to do with the landscape, we have a good way of identifying transcription factors for reprogramming to novel cell types. And we're trying to set up collaborations to do these things. These are reasonable plots. I can pretend to put p-values on stuff, but it's just fake. I think it's pretty reasonable. I mean, we think that most of our experience is that if you have a good culture, so now the alchemy part. The alchemy part is it turns out these reprogramming protocols don't just depend on the transcription factor. The dominant effect seems to be the culture. If you have a good culture that you can grow the cell type you want to reprogram to, that seems to be what's going on. And so the alchemy part is in the culture. So we're now trying to figure out if we can rationally make good cultures instead of doing alchemy. But the data, we have some thoughts, but I think that's the future. But I think if we can do that and combine it with this, we can really start doing rationally designed reprogramming to cell types.
Sorry, I'm confused by the many dots.
Each one is a transcription factor.
But you know them all. You know which one's there.
Yeah, I know which one's there, but I just labeled the ones that have been used in successful protocols.
But should I think of unlabeled dots in this upper...
Yes, as potential things.
As potential things.
Yeah.
So these are all testable predictions.
In principle, if we could make any of the, if we could reproduce any positive controls. So the problem is we can't reproduce them. The problem is that there's a lot of stuff that's published with 600 citations that no one except for the lab who published them can reproduce. So we spent a long time setting up this liver experiment. And if you look at it honestly, we get back their data, but their data is crap.
So what does it say about your predictions then?
Huh?
What does it say about your predictions?
I don't know what it says about my predictions. It says that we can't test them because we don't have a good culture. It says that culture is dominant. That's what I would argue in these reprogramming protocols is that really the dominant thing is the culture. And you can check that because you could express Yamanaka. You can switch the culture and go to MPCs. You can take this B cell to embryonic stem cell. If I don't grow it in two LIF conditions, I don't get anything. Right? And so what I would say is that this is part of the solution. I think, unlike it's presented in the literature, experimental literature, really the dominant thing we have to do is engineer good cultures. So we have to think about how we make these cocktails. And if we can do that, then we could probably reprogram much easier than doing the transcription factor. That's the conclusion I come to. These are fine. We do pretty good. We do better than just gene expression. We do better than ordering. Many of these are postdictions. But really, if we want to do what this engineering problem of doing reprogramming, we have to think about cultures. And we have to optimize that. And that's why I think that's why the Yamanaka works so well. How long do people spend optimizing how to grow stem cells? Right? The culture. The double feeder. I mean, that's what I take from these things.
What are the variables in the culture? I mean, the iron concentrations?
The growth factors. The growth factors.
Which growth factors?
Yeah, the growth factors is everything.
Yeah, so
yeah, and often people use things like serum, which... Serum is just cow's blood. I mean, you don't even know what... You know, people haven't even done good things. So, it's kind of interesting. But I don't know. But I would say the model is good at organizing data. It tells you how to plot stuff. I think it feels to me like the early days of critical phenomena. I think there's something there. You plot enough stuff, there's something going to come out. I'm just telling you the truth. All right. So that was that part about how we're using physics to try to do some phenomenology and biology. But you know, I give these talks, and whenever I go to a physics department, people are always like, why are you still in a physics department? So So this is my answer to that, which is that I think thinking about biology actually can tell you something very fundamental about physics. And what I'm going to talk about is some stuff we've been doing where we're trying to understand the physics of information in a way that is very, that I'll make clear, which is very much Landauer, Bennett, Charlie Bennett kind of feelish thing to it, for those of you who know what that means. And the inspiration for this was actually because I was reading Carnot's original treatise a while back, because I just was. Because this was like the last, I read somewhere where this was the last paper that was like a scientific kind that was still written, addressed to the general public. And so he wrote this really interesting thing called The Reflections on the Motive Power of Heat and on Machines to Develop That Power. And right, and his basic idea, for those of you who don't know, is that like there's a fundamental limit to the efficiency of an engine. It's called the Carnot bound. And it doesn't matter what kind of engine you have. You have a steam engine, a car engine, a rocket engine. And his basic point was, and I like this quote, which says, in order to consider in the most general way the principles of the production of motion by heat, it must be considered independently of any mechanism or any particular agent. It is necessary to establish principles applicable not only to steam engines, but to all imaginable heat engines, whatever the working substance and whatever the method by which it operated. Right? And so I was thinking about this stuff because I hang around at BU and there's a lot of synthetic biologists and I hang around the engineers because they unfortunately happen to be the most interesting people around BU, except for the condensed matter theorists who I also hang around. And my thought was, I've been thinking about these biochemical networks for a long time. Can we say something fundamental about their ability to process information? Right? Can we think about bounds on information processing or statistics like that? And the basic idea was that instead of engines, I'll think about biochemical networks. And I have a series of conjectures. There's two published pieces of paper, which are all on toy models, because I'm a physicist, I solve toy models first, and I've been trying to prove general stuff. And the basic idea, the conjectures I have, is that the ability of cells to perform computations about their environment is fundamentally constrained by non-equilibrium thermodynamics. And the basic idea is that learning about the environment requires energy. I will define learning in a very precise way. And learning more requires more energy. And this is basically a statement that something about, there's a fundamental relationship between statistical inference and statistical estimators and thermodynamics, just like there is one between computation and thermodynamics. And more practically, we wanted to think about how you could use thermodynamics, okay, I'll skip the last part, to design synthetic computing circuits. And so, like I said, I was reading this Carnot thesis. I was also reading Feynman's lectures on computation, because I was embarrassed because an electrical engineering friend of mine, who works at Genelia actually now, told me how great they were, and I was embarrassed I had never read them. So I was reading these things, and the interesting thing about Feynman is he's very persuasive. He tells you that you should be thinking about whatever he's lecturing about. And there's this chapter in here on the thermodynamics of computation. And in that chapter, he basically talks about how both computation and statistical inference are related to information, and that information is related to thermodynamics, right? We know this from Maxwell Demons, we know this from the stuff that Landauer's been doing, we know this from the stuff that Charlie Bennett did at IBM. And so my thought was that if cells also do computations, they also do statistical inference, so there should be some very deep relationship between these biochemical networks that do computations and statistical inference and thermodynamics. And so the goal was to try to understand that, tease that out, and try to think about what that means. And so if you go through Feynman's lectures, or Charlie Bennett's lectures, the fundamental thing you come up with is that lesson you should learn is that information is physical. You should never think about information in the abstract. You should think about where it's stored, right? So these are two pictures from Landauer's original paper, where he basically says, look, I can imagine information is stored in a bit of information is stored in a bistable well. Or I can imagine it's stored in the position of some particle. Charlie Bennett did a lot of stuff with what he called the basic atomic message, where he imagined a gas of particles in some volume. And if if a particle was on the left, it was a zero. If the particle was on the right, it was a one. And the reason he liked that is because he could do ideal gas law computations with it, right? Could expand the gas, not expand the gas, compress it. And in a biochemical network, the information is stored in the numbers of proteins of different forms, right? And so what we wanted to understand is that given that we know where the information is stored in a biochemical network in these proteins, can we say something about thermodynamic constraints on the ability of these biochemical networks to process information? And so I'm a physicist by training. I always solve toy problems. And the toy problem I solved was actually one that was put forward by Howard Berg. So Howard Berg is a pioneering biophysicist, and he spent his whole life really working out bacterial chemotaxis, which is basically how bacteria detect a chemical gradient or process information about the environment. And his basic point was that bacteria do random walks up a gradient, right? So they kind of do this, and they tumble, reorient, but there's a bias in the way they random walk. And in the early days when he was thinking about this, he had this paper in 1977 in Biophysical Journal, another really great paper, which is called The Physics of Chemoreception, where he's basically asking, how can a bacteria estimate the concentration of some external ligand? A ligand is just some chemical, right? And so in this paper, inspired by chemotaxis, he sets up a beautiful toy problem. And the toy problem is basically this. Imagine I have some receptor, and it has to estimate the concentration of some chemical outside the environment. And the point is that this chemical binds at some rate K plus C, and it unbinds at some rate K minus. And what the bacteria gets to do is it gets to monitor this time series for some long time T. So what the bacteria gets is unbound, bound, unbound, bound, unbound, bound, unbound, bound. It gets a long series, right? And it has to estimate the concentration from that. And we'll assume for simplicity for now that the idea is that in one state it signals, in another state it signals differently. And the idea is to estimate the concentration again. And the important point is that due to fundamental biophysical reasons, this process is always going to be stochastic. Right? And so this stochasticity is going to lead to uncertainty in my estimate of the concentration. And so Berg and Purcell asked, how do I take this long time series and turn it into a single statistic, a statistical estimator? And there's a lot of work on all this stuff.
Are you assuming independent events? I mean, if something comes off, it's not more likely to go on than another one going on.
In this simplest model, no. But it's not going to make it. No. What
we're using correlations in these time.
Oh, yes, there could definitely be correlations in.
There's definitely correlations. What those are, I see. The distribution of these times, and
not right now. Right? Not right now.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point. The whole point is, what should I compute? Mm-hmm. Right? You have to have some model. Berg and Purcell basically suggested that you should calculate the average signaling time, and they said your uncertainty basically goes like 2/n, where n is the number of binding events. So everything you say is basically goes into renormalizing n effective, because it's the central limit theorem thing. And there's actually lots of work done on, if I have correlated bindings, how does n go to n effective? So what you say is not a big problem for what we do at the moment. And so the whole point was this uncertainty in this concentration went like something like 2/n, right? And so they set up this thing. They said, let's calculate the average signaling time. Let's do 2/n. And they said, great, we're done. But again, we want to think about thermodynamics, right? And the lesson we learned was that we should think about the physical implementation of this. So what you can do is you can explicitly construct a biochemical network to compute this Berg-Purcell statistic. It turns out that for the biologist, it's just a two-component system with a downstream protein, and the receptor phosphorylates the downstream protein, X turns into X star, and this number of X star basically is your best estimate. And it turns out that the important point is that this is done in a rate-dependent manner, right? And so, since we're thinking about computations and Landauer, it turns out that you can actually reinterpret this kind of simple network in terms of computations. So, you know, memory is the number of activated phosphorylated proteins. Writing to memory is phosphorylating. Erasure of memory is deactivation. Energy dissipation, right? Now I want to ask, how do we measure energy? And energy dissipation here turns out to be related to entropy production due to a lack of detailed balance. No, pretty easy. And so, again, we expect from Landauer that because I'm averaging this thing over long periods of time and I'm erasing information, I should have to consume energy in order to learn anything, right? Landauer's results don't say the computer should be physical. It should work for any biochemical thing, too. And so you can go back and measure stuff. So you can calculate the power that's dissipated by this circuit as a function of your uncertainty, as a function of parameters. You calculate this power by basically mapping this to a Markov process using these kind of ideas of low... whatever, it doesn't matter. Liebowitz and Spohn measuring lack of detail balance, blah, 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 for a Markov chain. Entropy production is well-defined, and what you can show is that learning requires consumption of energy. As my power consumption goes to zero, my uncertainty goes to infinity. You can also show analytically some things. And underlying it, you know this has to be true even for physical arguments. Because if I'm averaging over a time t, I'm breaking time reversal symmetry. And if I'm breaking time reversal symmetry, you know I better be consuming energy. Right? So this is basically... what we argue is a biological manifestation of Landauer's principles. Boris is giving me very nasty looks, so I have to figure out what's unhappy about it and what he's unhappy about, but I think this is pretty solid. So at least in this case, you know, we argue that if you want to learn something, you have to consume energy. And we're trying to prove this in general. We have some ideas of how to use Jarzynski-like inequalities to do these things. Yes, Boris?
But learn how fast.
Oh, yeah, we can talk about how fast.
Well,
no, I have a time t.
There's power, and there is energy, and there's a time scale.
You have to consume energy in real time, right? You can ask about... you're asking about...
I'm just trying to understand whether...
You get an energy?
To energy, or the rate of acquisition of bits.
Oh, yeah, that's a big question. But here they're the same thing, because there's a t. There's a T, which is basically the rate I did phosphorylate. So you can go back. There's a time scale on which I average. It turns out I don't know the answer. Your question is a subtle one, and I can talk to you about it, and I don't understand fully the answer. So part of what we're trying to do is when we try to use these Jarzynski-like things, we run into that problem smack dab, and it's hard. And actually, I think Boris and I think Eric and Massimo did it all wrong in their last paper. anyway, it doesn't matter. We consider Berger Poiseuille considered a particular estimator. Do I have 5 more minutes? Because I'll be done in 5 minutes. The particular estimator, which is this average signaling time. But you can imagine constructing some other estimator. You know, you can calculate the average duration of the non-signaling times, and this turns out to be actually better because it's the maximum likelihood estimator. Or you can consider some general statistic, and we know it's going to go like alpha over n. And the basic intuition here is the bound times actually don't depend on the concentration. Only the unbound times do. So the bound times are stochastic, but they have no information. So what I should really do is any estimators that can make the bound times as deterministic as possible is going to be better, because I lose no information, but I kill all the noise. And the question is how you would do that, right? So you can imagine, so this unbound time, right, again, is just, it has no information about the bound time. So that's like
low concentration? Because couldn't the bound time depend on how many other elements are there knocking into it?
No, the bound time, it's all local. It's interaction, free energy of the interaction with the binding pocket.
Okay.
That's just the way like the binding and unbinding works. What you're saying is really rebinding events, right?
Well, what unbinds it? I mean,
there's a free energy, right? You have thermal fluctuations.
Yeah. It's
just thermal fluctuations. And you know it has to be that regime, otherwise you could never switch between them. You need new samples, right, at some rate. So it's thermal fluctuations. So you can think about how you model these things. And the basic idea is that you can imagine now if this receptor now can basically go through multiple states where it consumes energy, and this is, for example, what a G protein does, then you could basically imagine that I can create different statistical estimators by basically running a protein, and here, for example, through a cycle where I go through all these things. And by consuming energy, I can basically deterministically switch the protein, right? This is what rhodopsin does. This was actually inspired by your paper. So as I go through here, I reduce the variability of the signaling time, right? And so by consuming energy, I can go from this Berg-Poiseuille estimator to this kind of optimal maximum likelihood estimator. And here, we get this funny data collapse, which is we don't understand still at the moment, which is that you can look at the estimator for these different things. And again, the whole point is that now I'm running probability flux through here by consuming ATP. And you can calculate asymptotics. But the interesting thing is that the efficiency of this estimator depends on the energy consumed per independent sample. So it turns out to depend just on how much energy per binding event that's consumed. So you can data collapse. I only show the data collapse data, but we don't understand why. And asymptotically, as I go through longer and longer chains, I basically reach maximum likelihood estimation. And so for reasons we don't quite understand, you get this data collapse, and there seems to be some fundamental connection, at least in this model, and in every model we've actually set up of statistical estimators numerically, between the efficiency of an estimator, how in statistical language that's how good an estimator, statistical estimator works, and thermodynamics and entropy production of the corresponding Markov chain. So as far as we know, this is the first time anyone's made any kind of connection between statistics and thermodynamics. Maybe it exists, but we don't know it. And we don't know why it would be. And in particular, it seems to depend on the energy consumed per sample. Don't know why that happens, but we're thinking about it. And so this was basically what I meant by learning better requires more energy. And we would like to prove some general fluctuation-like theorems. So we're trying to think about whether we can use Jarzynski-like arguments. Antonio Celani has one I like. There's a lot of people doing this, but most of the time I find those unsatisfying for various reasons I can get into with people. So what's the lesson for all this stuff? So again, I said about synthetic circuits. Natural circuits look like this. This is a state-of-the-art to detect synthetic circuits. And most people just think the left is more complicated, but I would argue fundamentally what's missing from synthetic biology is this active consumption of energy. So how can we think about building in these futile cycles? Because these futile cycles are fundamental, I would argue, to how they can process information. Because of these kind of relationships between thermodynamics.
It seems like you're assuming local thermal equilibrium is operative.
At the level of the receptor, yes. Of binding and unbinding kinetics.
I don't know, from biology, you know, one thing leads to another thing and then something else comes and feeds back. Maybe I guess if it's because you're focusing just locally.
I mean, receptor binding and unbinding is very well described in almost all systems by basically two state systems. Of receptors basically toggling back and forth. I mean, I can show you tons of data collapses. I mean, it's something Ned worked on a lot. I mean, it's really.
With some time scales, like, I mean, because then something else will happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not talking. We're ignoring genetic feedbacks or upregulation or the. Yeah. But these are time scales of very, very short.
Short, right? Like milliseconds or shorter. Probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, microseconds.
Yeah. And so I'm working with Caleb Basher, who's a postdoc, and he's set up this amazing, really interesting system to do post-transcriptional synthetic biology, which doesn't exist yet, but he's working on it. And we're trying to figure out if we can test these ideas, if we can incorporate some lessons from this stuff. And so I think, you know, this is kind of interesting. Just like the engines told us the second law, I feel like, you know, I'm working on particular examples, but I think there's something deep there about information, and in particular about statistics. And information, which, as far as I know, no one has really thought that much about. So the conclusion of this part of this thing is biological information is also physical, takes energy to construct better statistical estimators, at least in this toy model. And computing any estimator with a biochemical network requires energy is our conjecture. We showed that for this Burke-Purcell estimator. We could use the same network downstream of this thing for this class of estimators. And I think there's implications for synthetic biology. And in particular, the lesson is that we should start thinking about how we're going to put in futile cycles into synthetic circuits. Because probably if we want to do complicated enough real-time monitoring of biological circuits, they need to consume stuff. This was my group until they're all slowly leaving me because of my uncertainty about where I'm going to be. this is Charles. He's in Paris. This is Alex. He was just here. Javad just graduated. These people helped me a lot. These guys, even though they're not in any of our papers, have been our lifeblood as far as stem cell biology. They're the only group I really believe. They're our friends, Daryl Cart and Laertes. And Katie, poor Katie, spent a long time trying to reproduce experiments for us. David Schwab is my best friend in science. I write a lot of papers with him. The Sloan and the Simons Foundation and the NIH for some money. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I have a question about this analogy up here. So you want me to imagine a little ball rolling around?
Yes.
On some some hills.
I really want you to imagine a frustrated spin system.
Well, let's just stick to the simple one. So what is the z-axis?
The energy. That kind of point.
When a ball is rolling on a landscape, it actually does move the z. So is that really a physical dimension, or is it an energy? You have a ball rolling around on a surface. It's actually moving in z. So
the ball just represents some place I'm in state space, right? So it represents the ball being here in this two-dimensional axis, of course, corresponds to some in this model. Some transcription factor on and off. It's overdamped dynamics, right?
It's overdamped dynamics.
It's completely overdamped dynamics. That's always the analogy.
That's not what I'm asking here is you have two dimensions here that are representing the spatial dimension, say.
Yes.
I mean, sort of as a general representation.
And where I sit on that tells me which transcription factors are on and which are off. And once you tell me that, there's no
question about a sort of more fundamental question about the idea of a ball rolling on. The ball rolling is not a good analogy because for a ball to be rolling on a landscape, you have motion in the z direction. But here there is no spatial z direction, right?
There is, because once I flip a spin, say, right, my energy changes so that I also move in the z direction, right? That's what the potential is basically saying.
Well, let's not talk about spins. Let's just talk about this ball rolling on a three-dimensional surface. A ball rolling on a three-dimensional surface has got kinetic energy in the z direction.
Yeah, but it's overdamped.
There's no overdamped. There's no inertia.
It's non-inertial dynamics of a ball.
But the z direction can't both be energy and space. That's what I'm saying. The analogy of a ball rolling on a surface is just, it doesn't work.
I agree with you. I think the important point is just the potential surface. That there is a potential surface, and that to each configuration of genetic, each gene expression thing, I can assign an energy. And then you can imagine there's some dynamics that, you know, I think this is the usual thing in thermal barrier crossing too. You draw a ball, but you don't mean a ball, right? I mean.
Like you can draw the ball, like for example, let's say you wanted to have simple harmonic motion in the X direction.
You can.
Well, let's forget about the damping.
The damping is fundamental, you can't forget about it.
If you put a parabolic bowl, it's not going to go have simple harmonic motion.
Imagine I put it in a parabolic ball with really, really high friction. That's what you're imagining.
Okay, but a parabolic ball is not the shape you need for simple harmonic motion.
I think you're taking this analogy much more seriously than I am. Continue
this offline. Do you have any more questions?
So all of your analysis you did was with microarray data that is bulk cell populations, which comprise a number of different actual cells. How do you feel your data would change if you were to do RNA-seq on the single cell level and use the information that you have on the population of each of your cell population?
I understand. So you're asking me. So I'm in the vast minority of people. I have never seen anyone use single cell RNA-seq for anything useful. My feeling is that most of the time people just put a spread around a bulk. I haven't seen where, my feeling is, yeah, I take these axes, I take your RNA-seq, and I put these axes, and I can put a spread around every point. Now, can I do something more than that? Is of course very useful because maybe you have long tails, maybe you see these things. But beyond putting a spread on a mean, I'm not sure. I mean, it's not like that. I don't know. Can I now tell you something about? So the question that we have been thinking about is, can I tell you something about the width of the basin by using the single cell thing? And we don't have the data for it. I don't actually know how to do it, even if we did have the data, but that is a problem I want to think about. So like here, the width is strongly, I don't know. Maybe you can find flat directions. I don't have a good answer except for that I get to put a cloud down instead of a point. Now, maybe you can learn something from putting that cloud down.
But frankly, I don't understand your issue here. Of course, there is the question of, if you like, whatever, technical variation.
Yeah.
That's a noise in single cell data, which presumably is more of it than population average, where you have more.
You get less genes. You get less genes. The problem is you get 60, right? in a fluid dime thing, you get like 60 genes, right?
No, like 15,000.
You got 60 cells, but you got the whole genome, right? But in your model, right, everything is autonomous, right?
Yeah.
Your Hamiltonian lives independently of every cell, right? Cells are not coupled.
Oh, agreed.
So,
in principle.
Noise issue aside, you just get 60 times the amount of data from a single experiment.
I just don't know anything clever to do. Let me rephrase it. I've seen a lot of people get information. I haven't seen anyone get something really clever beyond spreads. And I read a small fraction of the literature. It's hard to read more than that. In stem cells, I can tell you that I haven't seen something super clever. So everyone just says, oh, iPSs are different from this cloud, that cloud. But when you reanalyze it yourself, you're like, oh, they're in the same cloud. So I can only tell you in stem cells. I don't know in other fields. I haven't seen it.
Right, you automatically get the same conditions,
yeah,
which you say are very, very important, replicate.
Yeah, no, that's
right.
True.
So comparing single cells, their noise aside, from a single experiment is vastly better.
No, it's always better. No. It's clearly better, but I don't know. I interpreted the question as, can you do something more clever than just put a spread on stuff?
Okay, we should continue this offline and make fun of it again.